Patanjali has made to this world. He gave everything, basically. He told us how to clean the body, how to clean the mind, and how to clean the speech. Mind, body, and speech. Those are the three things that matter most. So he was the sort of the originator of all these three sciences. Are you okay? There's a chair there.
Yeah, I'll sit on the floor.
You want to sit on the floor and you're able to see the screen okay?
Yeah.
You can move a little.
Sometimes I need something to support my neck.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. That's fine. All right, so that's what it is. But before we get going, let's get some introductions quickly so we can just tell our, introduce ourselves. First name, last name, what kind of work you do and where you do it, and why did you decide to weather the weather today?
My name is Tom Souders. I'm very happy to be here, so I'm glad that I'm finishing yoga teacher training, and this is part of it, so it's really awesome.
Very good.
I'm Dave Owen, and I've been coming on and off to a lot of sessions that Sukhash has led, and come when I can, and I work as an herbalist, and have a meditation practice I'm developing.
Very good.
My name is Jessica Shepherd. I'm an art director at the Dharma Guild, and I've been a student of Subhash's for about 4 years now, and I love it. I'm going to get my teacher license soon.
She's going in for teacher training.
To be my guru, so.
Uh-oh. Good. Thank you, Jessica.
My name is Eleanor Lee, and I'm retired, I guess. I've been doing yoga for 4 or 5 years, and I've just been enjoying reading different things and learning about the whole process of how it can affect your mental and physical health.
Excellent, Eleanor. Thank you. Karen?
Hi, I'm Karen Hawkins. I've been coming to Subhash's class for almost a year now, since I moved here from Richmond, Virginia, where I did yoga teacher training there. So I've been interested in the sutras, the philosophy of yoga for quite some time, and I've been coming to the workshop every chance that I can.
Very good, Karen. Camille?
I'm Camille. I teach yoga. I know it's surprising. It seems like everybody here is a yoga teacher in training, but I teach, and then I also, I sing. I do a lot of things in the performing arts. But, and I'm a student of life, and Subhash is one of my greatest teachers.
Oops. Thank you. Thank you, Camille. Okay, so, who attended the last session? I think you didn't attend the last. Were you there last time? No.
I listened to your podcast. So I wasn't here, but I did listen to your podcast.
Okay, so it looks like everyone is new here. I mean, at least for today's session. Okay. So, what we can do is I'll give you a brief overview, first of all, of what Yoga Sutras is all about and what we've been doing so far. And then we'll kind of continue from where we left off the last time. I'm sure you roughly know what Yoga Sutra is all about. Yoga Sutra is about, like in the definition we just saw, it's about cleansing the mind. Yoga Sutra is a very ancient text written by Patanjali. Given by Patanjali. Nobody used to write in those days. So it was given to us by Patanjali. And the antiquity of it is not very well known, but roughly people say anywhere between 3,000 years to some older period. That's how old this is. And it's not something that Patanjali really put together new. He just kind of collated, compiled all the available information, put his own mind into it, and it's a combination of philosophy, psychology, methodology, practical approach to life, basically. That's what it is all about. Why do we say it's about life? Because it only talks about the mind. And as we know, mind is the one that really controls everything for us. I mean, these days, science, medicine and science know that majority of the problems, physical ailments that we have, they have their origin and the source being the stress and the mind. It's very commonly understood and recognized now. So it's the mind which really needs to be fixed before we can fix anything. So Patanjali was obviously a great psychologist, scientist, whatever you want to call it, yogi. And he gave us this whole science of yoga, which tells us how to understand the mind, having understood it, how to fix it, how to cleanse it, purify it. Once it is purified, that's the only time, he says, that we can get to know our true identity. Otherwise, our ego is so strong, it doesn't let us know who we are. And then we just play hide and seek with ourselves and never know and never understand the reality of who we are. Okay, so that's the whole purpose of this Yoga Sutra. And again, very quickly and briefly, there are 4 chapters in the Yoga Sutras. Everyone knows that, no? The first one is called Samadhipada, which talks about the definition of yoga. Understanding of what yoga is all about, what it does, what it entails, and how to go about attaining or achieving the objectives of yoga that have been laid out for us. Okay? Basically, it's all understanding who we are, basically. That's the Samadhi Pada. The second chapter is called, anybody remember the names? Sadhana Pada. Sadhana, S-A-D-H-A-N-A. Sadhana means, again, methodology or techniques of doing something. So Sadhana Pada is basically, it starts out by talking about stress. It's called Klesha in Sanskrit. And what stress is, what kleshas are, how they happen, and what causes us to get stressful. And goes into a fair amount of discussion on the underlying concepts of yoga, which are based on this philosophy called Sankhya. So the second chapter has a huge component of the Sankhya philosophy. Then it goes into the law of karma, which is all the reincarnation, rebirth, etc., etc. And then, having said all that, having given us why we get stressed out, why we have this term called klesha, he says the only way you can get rid of, well, he says the technique or the methodology or the sadhana for doing away with this klesha, for getting rid of this stress, is to practice these 8 limbs of yoga. So that's why it's called the sadhana pada, or the methodology or the technique for removing our stress entirely. And he says if you practice these 8 limbs of yoga, then you can become peaceful and get rid of your stress. And that's like he said, you know, that's the only way to recognize your true identity. Okay, so that's the second chapter. The third chapter is called Vibhuti Pada. Vibhuti is a Sanskrit word which means supernatural, supernormal powers that you can attain through the practice of yoga. Okay, so chapter 3 goes into a fair amount of details about what meditation practice is, what exactly is meditation, what it does to us. And it goes into variety of practices which will give you a variety of supernormal powers. There are a large number of them listed in the text. Then the fourth chapter goes a little more into depth about the state of the mind which you can achieve through the practice of yoga. Eventually, once you have recognized yourself, Patanjali calls it the state of, the Sanskrit word he uses is kaivalya. And the closest loose translation of kaivalya is freedom, basically. Not 100%, but like I said, loose translation is freedom. Freedom from suffering, freedom from this whole cycle of birth and rebirth, etc. That's what the meaning is. Kaivalya means to attain a state of the mind where it's nothing but total peace and bliss all the time. No stress, no strain, no anxiety, nothing. And it also goes into much more discussion about the whole philosophy of Sankhya again, you know, because that's the basic underlying philosophy of yoga. Does everyone know Sankhya? Anybody here heard the term Sankhya philosophy?
Not sure. Can you
spell it? S-A-N-K-H-Y-A. Sankhya philosophy. So anyway, you know, there are six different philosophical streams in India, six of them. And I'm not going to list or talk about them now, but yoga and Sankhya are two very closely related. The other important philosophical streams are Vedanta and Mimamsa. Has everyone heard the term Vedanta? No, Veda, Vedanta, somewhat. Anyway. So that's the, there are six streams, and two of the streams of these philosophical understanding that we are interested in primarily are the Sankhya and yoga. Okay. So yoga is based very largely on this philosophy called Sankhya, and that's what we talk about. In this chapter 4, okay?
Those schools of thought develop at about the same time?
Sequentially, in a sense, not exactly at the same time, but they were all an outgrowth of the message that was kind of hidden in all the Vedas and Upanishads. But then, because those were very esoteric and very deep and hard to understand messages, so these six different philosophers, yogis, and, you know, scientists, you can call them, they kind of took some aspects of this Vedic philosophy and kind of from there they evolved their own philosophical stream. The objective of every one of these is to attain, liberation, everyone. Techniques are slightly different, the concepts are slightly different, the methods are slightly different. Okay, so these are the six philosophies. You know, the very fundamental concept in Sankhya, if you recall, is the statement where it says there are two realities. Two realities being Purusha and Prakriti. We have talked about these a lot. Purusha is the soul, the atma, the self, etc. That's called Purusha. And that's pure consciousness, pure being. That's Purusha. And Prakriti is everything else that we can perceive through our senses, through thinking, through our mind, through our, the material being. Okay? So all this body, mind, intellect, everything is a part of Prakriti. And the only thing that's conscious is the pure consciousness, which is called Purusha. The mind, body, etc., they are not conscious, but they borrow consciousness from Purusha to function in this world, so to say. That's how the functioning happens. Okay, so with that little background, what we have been doing is, the sutras, there are a total of 195 sutras in this text, divided into four chapters. for the sake of kind of convenience and understanding in a more, in a manner that I feel is more appropriate, I have not gone through absolutely the sequential, you know, process. You know, I didn't take Sutra number 1 in chapter 1 and go through that sequentially. I did some in sequence, then I break the sequence, go into chapter 2, then break the sequence, go into chapter 3, then break the sequence, go back to chapter 2. That's what we will be doing. So currently we are sort of doing the last phase of these 8 limbs of yoga. Okay? So that's what we've been studying in the last several sessions now, many sessions. And does everyone know the 8 limbs of yoga? No. Who can recite 8 limbs of yoga quickly?
The yamas,
and yamas. Yamas, niyamas,
asana,
asana,
pranayama,
meditation.
Hmm?
Pratyahara.
Pratyahara. That's, I'll tell you what these are quickly.
No.
Pratyahara, and then dharana, dhyana,
samadhi.
So these are the 8 limbs, or some people like to call it steps or states of yoga, you can call them. Yamas and niyamas are ethical, moral, social guidelines. Things like never to tell a lie, don't hurt anybody, don't steal anything, be very clean in the mind, be very clean in your environment, etc., etc. These are the 10. 5 yamas and 5 niyamas. Okay? They tell us how to interact socially with others as well as how to discipline your own mind. So yamas are social interaction and niyamas are for the self. How to control your own, how to discipline yourself by different things. Asana is the ability to, what's asana?
Sit.
Sitting. Ability to sit for a long period of time so that you can meditate. That's asana. What's pranayama?
Breathing.
Breathing exercises, breathing practices which will help us cleanse the body, purify the body, purify the nervous system, purify the mind, and prepare us for meditation. That's, everything is to prepare for meditation. What's pratyahara?
Sense control.
Sense withdrawal, sense control, sense understanding what the senses do, why they are so attracted to their objects of attraction. Every one of these 5 senses just runs toward these objects. And the ability to shut the mind from any influence from these 5 senses, that's called pratyahara. And that's a kind of a prerequisite for meditation. If the mind is constantly running around through these 5 senses, there's not much chance that we can sit and meditate. Then the final 3 are the 3 stages of meditation. Dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. What is dharana? Focus and concentration. So that's the initial part of meditation where you learn how to focus and stay completely concentrated on some object. And then what's meditation?
Dhyana.
Dhyana. So that's the same thing, basically staying focused on an object. In certain styles of meditation, the object of meditation for dharana can be different from the object of meditation in your dhyana process. It can be the same. Okay? It could be the same or it could be 2 different objects altogether. In the course that I teach here on meditation, you know, I do this morning program on meditation. In the approach that I have followed so far, I have used a separate object of focus for dharana, and then I suggest that you transition to your own mantra, whatever meditation you want to do, with a different object of meditation. Okay, so that's the approach I've been taking, but there's no hard and fast rule. You can have the same object or a slightly different object. Okay. That's dharana, dhyana. Samadhi is total absorption. Once you have been able to calm the mind enough that it has now settled down and it does not want to drift away from the object meditation, and you are able to stay there for a long enough period, totally absorbed in the meditation, that's called samadhi. Okay, so we have been focusing in the last few sessions on the final three stages of meditation called dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. In the last session, what we did was that we completed all the sutras in chapter 1 that relate to meditation. So we completed up to that part last time. Okay? And then what we said was that we will continue with the discussion on meditation with the sutras which are in the chapter 3. Like I said, chapter 3, which is the Vibhutipada, which is this section related to the supernormal powers, it focuses entirely meditation because it's different techniques of meditation which will allow you to attain these supernormal powers. Okay? So is that okay so far? As a way of introduction, any questions so far that come to mind?
When you say an object on which to concentrate, what do you mean, a physical object?
Or? It could be anything. What Patanjali says, it can be any object. See, he actually has told us there are 23 elements that we are composed of. 23 elements. Does anybody remember those 23? Quickly?
Quickly?
No? Not quickly? Slowly? Yes, go ahead. Go ahead. There are 23 of them.
Oh, and I just said ego.
Ego is one of them, yeah.
Okay.
One of the 23.
That's good.
Intellect.
Anger, maybe. Anger.
No. That's a part of the mind. Okay.
Memory.
Memory is not listed as such, but because memory is a part of the ego, they say.
The five sense organs.
Five sense organs. Which are the eyes, ears, nose, etc. Okay, five sense organs. What else? You have notes.
I do. Five active organs? I'm trying to read my handwriting.
Organs of action.
Organs of action. Yes.
Okay, the five organs of action being hands for lifting, throwing, arms and legs and feet. That number two. Then, what are the other three? Quickly.
Speech, elimination, and reproduction.
Yes. So organs of elimination, organs of reproduction, and the organ of speech, which is the tongue.
Now I have something also here, is the tanmatras.
Yes.
So sense perceptions.
Sense perceptions.
With the sense organs, but they're
Two
different
things. Yes.
Yes.
Sense organs are external to the body. I mean, they are, you can see them, touch them. Mm-hmm. Sense perception is what happens in the mind when things go through these five organs.
Right. Okay.
So when you smell something, the nose is an instrument. Mm-hmm. Nose being the instrument of smell, it allows you to receive those whatever comes in which makes you smell something. But that smell itself is felt in the mind. Mm-hmm. And that's called the tanmatra of smell. Tanmatra. Okay? So five sense organs, five sense perceptions, five organs of action, five elements. What are the five elements?
Fire.
Earth, water, fire, air, ether, five elements. That makes a 20. Then there is the ego, the mind, and the intellect. Those three. These 23 comprise this whole human structure, basically. So what Patanjali says, you can focus on any one of these 23. So what we do in the technique that I have been practicing myself and that what I promote, it's called mantra meditation. Mantra, what's a mantra?
Sound or word.
sound or a word or something that you fix your mind on, and that becomes a part of the mind, basically. So you're focusing on the element, one of the 23 elements called the mind, and then you said anger. You can focus on anger. You can meditate on anger. You can meditate on any emotion that you can think of. But you have to deeply focus on that emotion. Anger, jealousy, hatred, doesn't matter. There are stories in our ancient texts. You know, there was a guy named Pashupala or something, you know, a long time ago. Okay, he used to have a hatred for Krishna. Everyone knows who Krishna was, roughly. It's okay, if you don't know, that's fine. Okay, one of those characters in our ancient culture. Krishna was the reincarnation of God in the human form, if you know that, okay? So this guy had intense hatred for Krishna. And the story goes, I mean, there is a lot of stories around him, that through that intense hatred, he attained liberation. Because his mind was so one-pointedly focused on just one object, and that object was to hate Krishna. That's it. And he had no other focus in mind, and he attained liberation with that.
So if you can meditate on anger or something like that, it seems like your mantra could change over time, because there'd be different things that, like,
no, then you don't talk of mantra, then you just think of anger. That becomes your mantra then, anger.
But what if you get over that, and then like a year from now there's something else bothering you? That would be a different mantra that you
No.
Have.
Mm-hmm.
No? You still have the same one?
Just keep focusing on anger then. Once you attain liberation, you're done.
Doesn't the KKK focus on anger too?
Whatever, yeah. It doesn't matter.
No, I mean the KKK though.
I know what you're saying. but she's making a good point. You know, these people, these Islamic terrorists,
they
do the same thing. They say they are focusing on a certain aspect which, according to them, has been promoted by their religious scriptures. Yeah. And that is to destroy everybody who does not believe in Allah, on Islam. And they focus so much on that, they believe that if they do that, they'll go to heaven. They'll attain liberation. That's why they do it. But that's the whole point. The liberation happens because your mind is completely cut off from everything else.
No distractions.
When you say focus on anger, you don't necessarily mean feeling anger, or do you mean like sort of thinking about it as an idea?
Yeah, as an idea, as a thought, as an emotion, as a feeling. And you may initially start thinking about, you know, like for any word, any concept of meditation, and, you know, I've already talked about that in the past. You know, there are these concepts which are characteristics of meditation, right? Of the mantra or the object of meditation. Does anybody remember the three things that are associated with the mantra?
The word.
Yes. The word, the meaning, and the?
The sound.
And the knowledge, information. Shabda, artha, and jnana. So, what that means, those three characteristics of your object of meditation, in the beginning what it says is you can think about things that cause you anger. Right? What is causing you anger? What is making you angry? Okay? Let's say it is something that you're having in your family. I'm just picking something, right? Let's say you have some discussion with your spouse and makes you terribly angry or something. You can have that feeling of what caused that anger and think about it in depth. But don't allow the mind to get away from that concept. Okay, then don't start thinking, oh my God, you know, my wife did this, and her so-and-so brother did that, and then her brother did so-and-so, and then you kind of drift away completely from that whole concept. As long as you stay within the framework of these three characteristics that I've discussed, shabda, artha, and jnana, which is the sound, meaning of the object, and any related concepts or information, that's called jnana. Okay? As long as you can stay within the framework of these three attributes of your object, you are in a deep state of meditation at that point. And then you start refining it from there on further and further until you can get so totally absorbed that nothing else matters. Nothing else matters after that.
So I guess I'm a little confused because in the example you gave about your spouse, being mad at your spouse. So instead of thinking about different points about it, you should concentrate just on how you are feeling.
Yes, how you're feeling and what caused that feeling. What part of the interaction caused that feeling.
Can you give an example? Because, you know, I've been like watching some videos on like you're trying to like stay focused, how to like, you know, pay attention to like, you know, the thing that you're meditating on, right? It could be mantra, it could be like, you know, visualizing, you know, something.
Right.
Your breath.
Yes.
But when you talk about like, you know, either anger or happiness or something that made you really feel really like, you know, happy. So there's a sequence to that. So mm-hmm. once that sequence, you know, happens, you know, like the lady asked, do you go like, you know, beyond, you know, what, you know, happened? Because, you know, let's say like, you know, going on a cruise trip last year, like, you know, made me really happy.
Yes.
So there was a definite of, you know, steps, you know, in yes. that, you know, vacation.
You can think about that initially, yes.
It ended, you know, and then what do I do? Like, you know, when it ended, you know, do I go back, you know, right at the beginning?
You
know,
what you have to focus on is the, you know, you have to keep analyzing what caused that happiness. What is it that caused happiness? Think about it. What do you call happiness? Then you start thinking about all this whole concept. What is happiness? What caused that happiness? Is that permanent? Is that temporary? You know, and then you stay focused on that. That's it. That becomes your mantra then. Don't linger on the steps eventually.
Okay.
Keep bringing it to more subtler and subtler aspects of that feeling that you're talking about, that you're thinking about. What is at the deepest level which caused you happiness? You understand life, you know, you do these analyses, you begin to understand yourself much, much better.
Where is that in the Yoga Sutra specifically, so I can read it and follow it?
What about that?
That you were just describing, how to do the meditation, that particular
meditation. That's where, we're talking about that now, yeah. It's all over the book.
The whole thing. Okay.
You know, chapter one is full of, you know, toward the end. We discussed that last time. You, and now I'm going to talk about some of the other sutras now which talk about.
I've never heard of that style of meditation.
Hmm?
I've never heard of that style of meditation.
Of what?
Well, you were just talking about like focusing on anger.
Well, I mean, that's not mentioned in the sutras.
Right. Oh, okay.
That's not, the sutras don't say you focus on anger, but Patanjali says you focus on anything. Anything includes any of these 23 elements. These are the commentators who give you, once you start reading commentaries by different authors, they give you all these ideas. Okay. Okay, so what we will do is, you know, get started from, you know, from the sutra number 1 in chapter 3, etc. Okay. Well, it's a good idea to review these 5 states of the mind that will help us understand some of the concepts. Now remember, the sutras are a very It's a very cryptic way of writing things down, very cryptic, very brief, almost like a code. Okay? Because in those days, like I said, Patanjali didn't write anything. You know, he just gave these ideas through speech. And then he had to compose these in a very terse manner so that people could memorize them. There was no way to write down anything in those days. There was no printing press, no writing. 3,000 years ago, there was printing press, nothing. So everything was transmitted orally through oral transmission. So that's why they are very cryptic, very brief statements. So to understand these, you need a commentator. You need somebody who claims he or she understands, and then you read and through that commentary. One of the most recognized and sort of decorated commentators on Patanjali Yoga Sutras is Vyasa, V-Y-A-S-A, very ancient name. Many people claim that he lived at the same time that Patanjali did, so he knew Patanjali personally, basically. That's what many people claim. Nothing is known. So his commentary is considered to be the most authentic commentary, and almost every modern commentary makes a reference to that in some form or the other. Okay? So in his commentary, Vyasa states that it is a good idea to think of the mind as having five different states depending on the situation you are in. Okay? So the most common state of the mind where we are almost always, it's called the scattered state of the mind. Okay? The Sanskrit term used for scattered state of the mind is kshipta. K-S-H-I-P-T-A, kshipta. Okay? So that's the very scattered state of the mind where the mind just runs around different places, different thoughts, different ideas all the time, constantly not focusing on anything at all. What causes all these states of the mind to be different? The combination of the three gunas. You have to, you know, there's a lot of things that you have to kind of understand as a background. You know, otherwise, it's hard. So what are the three gunas? Three gunas?
Mood? Yes.
No, gunas, no, not.
Sattva,
rajas, and?
Tamas.
What you've been eating. Your diet? Like what you. Are those the kinds of.
No.
Those aren't the kinds of diet. Yeah.
Well,
they
do refer to those.
I'm coming to that. Okay, so sattva, rajas and tamas. What they claim is, and this is a part of the Sankhya philosophy again. What they say, well, it's now everywhere. You know, in all philosophies they use that. But Sankhya came up with these three gunas, they call them. They are the characteristics of every entity in this universe. Every entity in the universe, prakriti, is a composite of these three gunas at any given time. Three gunas being sattva means purity and cleanliness and positivity, etc. That's called sattva. Rajas implies all action, movement, ambition, gung-ho, type A personality, desire, etc., etc. They are all a part of this quality called. What did I say?
Rajas.
Remember these words. these concepts you have to know. You know, sattva, rajas, and tamas. You know, at least know the names and a rough idea of what they are. What's tamas? Dullness, laziness, lethargic being, sleepiness. You know, I like to add the word couch potato-ness. You know, when you always tend to think that, oh my God, my brain is fried. I can't think. I cannot do anything. All I want to do is to sit, watch football, drink a beer, and have a bag full of potato chips. That's it. And kill myself in the end. You laughed.
Yeah.
That's what many people do, right?
Yeah.
It's easy to do. That's why.
That's a part of tamas. Negativity. And most people end up doing a lot of bad things through the influence of tamas. Bad things, even killing, hurting people, telling lies, stealing something. All these negativities, they happen when you are in a state of tamas, basically. But that's not to say that all these are bad. You know, we need all these three in certain proportion. If you did not have rajas, you would not have the energy to come here and watch, listen to this talk. If you didn't have tamas, you would not sleep at night and be restful. You know, all these things are required, but in a certain proportion and at a certain given time. Not in a negative way. That's the whole idea. So when you are completely kind of driven by a combination of rajas and tamas, your mind is in the state of scattered brain, so to say. So that's the first state, normal during the waking state, mind constantly moving around, jumping around from one thought, from one idea to the other. That's called the kshipta state. That's the state when you sit for meditation, you start in that state. Okay? When you sit for meditation, you will start with that state where the mind is completely scattered all over the place. The next state that's listed is called mudha, M-U-D-H-A. What's mudha? Again, that same dullness. Basically, when you are much more driven by tamas, you get into a state of mudha where you are not able to think straight, you are sleepy, you are very tired, dejected, even things like depression, anxiety, etc. They are all a part of the mudha state. When you sit for meditation, there are sometimes it happens. You know, you begin to fall asleep, or you feel very lethargic, you feel very dull. Anybody ever felt that when you sit for meditation? You know, it happens sometimes. You just don't feel like doing it. You sit down, you start feeling sleepy or lethargic or very dull, and you want to get away from that meditation. It's okay. It happens to everybody. Nobody is isolated. That's the mudha state. It happens when you're very tired all the time. Now, when you're sitting for meditation, there does come a time when you feel that you are able to stay focused for some duration of time. Okay? So that state is called vikshipta. You add the prefix V and it becomes vikshipta state, is the mind where you are partially focused, partially scattered. So these are the states that you will be in, for example, when you're reading a book very, very intently and you're so absorbed in the book that if somebody called you, you probably won't even hear your name that somebody called you. That's because your mind is now completely cut off from other things and you are able to stay focused for some time. But suddenly some other thought may come and it's again disturbed. Again goes back to the kshipta state. Right? So that's called the vikshipta, partially scattered, partially focused, fixed. Then once you are able to sit and focus very intently, okay, for a longer period of time, that's called the state of ekagrata. Ekagra. Okay, ekagra means you're able to focus on one pointed focus that you are able to maintain for some amount of time. Okay, people who do, artists, for example, they get into that state. You know, they're painting something or drawing something, musicians, for example, when they're composing music or singing music, sometimes they get so deeply engrossed, nothing else matters. Okay? And it's the same state that you want to get into in your meditation, eventually. Ekagrata. Okay? And the final state which ekagrata leads you to is called niruddha. Niruddha. Niruddha means it's the state where you have now that means there is no thought whatsoever. There is no thought. Your mind is has been able to suppress every seed in your mind that can bring up thoughts. It almost becomes a seedless place then eventually. And that's the very final state of samadhi. And eventually Patanjali calls it the seedless samadhi. Nirbija samadhi, he calls it. Bija is a state, is a seed. So, fully niruddha, arrested state, is one-pointed and focused completely, without any distraction whatsoever.
So, when you talk about that state, I hear what you're saying about the state. When you say it's one-pointed, what do you mean by one-pointed there? So when I hear one-pointed, I think you're pointed at one something.
Yes.
But this sounds like... But is it your mantra, or have you completely...
Yes. No, yeah, mantra is okay.
That, or you're still...
You're still holding on to the mantra.
Still holding on to the mantra.
Yes. Okay. See, remember in the first chapter, we talked about two states of samadhi. Mm-hmm. One is called the sampragnyata, the other is called the asampragnyata. Remember, did we talk about, talking about Sutra 17 in chapter 1?
Yes.
You remember that?
I do remember.
Sutra 17 in chapter 1. Sampragnyata and asampragnyata. Sampragnyata samadhi is where you have an object of meditation still in your mind. A mantra or a thought or a feeling or an emotion, it still lingers in your mind. Okay? But that's the only thing. When in the very final stage of sampragnyata, that's all that there is. Okay. Then what Patanjali says, that you become one with that object. The observer, the observed, and the process of observation. The knower, the known, and the process of knowledge. Okay, they all merge into one entity. Okay? You know, it may seem weird.
It almost seems like we lose the ability to even describe what that is.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yeah. What I was going to say is, you know, it's, to me, you know, I'm repeating it like a parrot because I've read all this and I've understood it intellectually, but I've never experienced it myself. So I don't know what that means when Patanjali says that the observer, the observed, and the observation become one. The knower, the known, and the knowledge become one. I don't know what it really feels like because I have not experienced it myself in my own meditation yet. But that's what it says. So some of these things that I'm saying here are not from my experience, but from my intellectual understanding. And remember, every intellectual understanding can be tinged with what's in my ego. So, you have to take that with a pinch of salt, okay? Everything.
So we're really working toward letting go of all of that.
Exactly.
So we're using all of this to get us to the state where we just
let it all go. So we are using the mind to go beyond the mind, as they say.
Yes.
That's what they say. Because mind and body are the only instruments we have through which we can do all this. But the goal is to transcend all these things, transcend the body, transcend the mind, transcend the intellect, ego, everything, eventually. Okay? But that's the hard part. All right? So these are the five states of the mind.
What's the Sanskrit word for states? What's the Sanskrit word for states? States of the mind?
Just dasha, in Sanskrit dasha. Manasik dasha. D-A-S-H-A. There are different words. Sthiti, another word. Dasha is another word. Okay. So, you know, these first three or four sutras, we have already discussed it at some point, but I want to just review them with you one more time, just a kind of a quick review of these sutras from chapter 3. So the first sutra is about dharana. So remember what we have been doing in the past? We read the Sanskrit first. Okay, then I explain the word meaning of each word in the Sanskrit. And then we go through an understanding of what that means. Okay? So repeat after me. Desha bandha.
Desha bandha.
Chittasya.
Chittasya.
Dharana. That's the definition. Desha bandha. Chittasya. Dharana. Okay? That's the sutra number 1 in chapter 3. So the meaning of these words are, desha is a physical location or some location. It could be physical or even mental location. Desha. Desha also means country. Location, basically derived from location. Bandha means to bind something. To bind something to one location. Okay? Chittasya means, what is chitta?
Mind.
Mind field, mind. Okay? So the ability to bind the mind to one single object. That is called dharana. Okay? That's the initial focus, concentration of the mind, which will eventually lead us to other states of the meditation. Now, remember in the course that I teach here, I go through about 8 or 10 different styles of dharana, different techniques of dharana. So, for example, one of the things that we do is to focus on the candle flame. Has anybody done that before?
Yes.
Candle flame, gazing?
Like into the dark part of the flame?
Some part of the flame. It doesn't matter what dark, bright, that's up to you. You can focus on the dark part of the flame, bright part of the flame, on the wick itself, on the tip of the flame, it doesn't matter. Or the whole flame. The point is that you use that initially to develop that focus. So, when you apply this particular sutra to that focus, then desha bandha, that flame becomes your desha. That flame is your desha, that flame is your location that you're focusing on, is the ability to stay focused on that flame for a length of time, which calms the mind eventually. It settles the mind down. You do that for a few minutes, what I normally say is, if your total duration that you want to sit for meditation is about 30 minutes, do this initial candle gazing for about 10 minutes, and then transition to your mantra meditation for another 15 to 20 minutes. That's what normally I recommend. Okay? So, and we have, we talk about many other techniques of dharana in that sense. Breath is another, like you said, breath is another form of object of meditation. That becomes your desha. Okay? And there are many different breathing techniques that you can use as a form of dharana itself. So this dharana will eventually get you to a state, maybe which is called the vikshipta state. Remember we said partially focused, vikshipta state. So from kshipta state, it can help you transition to the vikshipta state, partially focused state. Okay? And then it can go back to kshipta, if you're not careful. Okay, now what is dhyana? That's the definition of the meditation part. So what it says is tat. So repeat after me. Tatra. Pratyaya. Ekatanata. Dhyanam. So tatra. Pratyaya. Ekatanata. Dhyanam. Tatra means where, then, at that point, at that stage. Where, what stage? When your mind has been partially focused. So once you have attained the state of dharana, tatra, that means then, at that time, what happens? Or what you're supposed to do? Pratyaya. What's pratyaya? Pratyaya is the content of the mind at any given time. What's in your mind? Content of the mind. That's what we talked about. It could be an emotion, it could be a thought, it could be a feeling, it could be an imagination, it could be a word, sound of a word, smell, taste, doesn't matter. Any one of those 23 elements could be a part of your mind at that time. And you focus on that and stay focused for a long period of time. So that becomes the pratyaya, as the content of the mind. Ekatanata. Ek means one in Sanskrit. Ek means one. Tan is to stretch something. Ekatanata is the ability to stretch something in unison for a long period of time. That's ekatanata. So dhyana is meditation. Dhyana is meditation. So meditation is the ability to stretch the same content of the mind for a long period of time. That's the definition of meditation, according to Mr. Patanjali. Now, remember, this is where you will, once you pick the object of meditation, mantra is the most common. Mantra is a pick a sound or a word, and then you repeat, or even a short phrase, and you repeat that over and over again, and that becomes your mantra. And every mantra, Patanjali says, that you can stay focused on those three attributes of that mantra. Remember? Three attributes I just talked about. Word. Meaning. And knowledge, information. Okay? Shabda, artha, jnana. Those are the three Sanskrit words Patanjali uses. Shabda means the sound or the word itself. Artha means its essence, its very essential meaning. And jnana is the knowledge or the information part. Okay, so what I'm saying, what's mentioned here is that the mind focused on a single object for a length of time, the concentration fluctuates between different aspects of the same object. And these aspects that I'm mentioning here are defined by those three characteristics. But
are you kind of intentionally doing that, fluctuating between the different aspects?
It will happen. Mind is going to be completely
all over the place.
Yeah. But what Patanjali says, can you bring them back? Can you bring the mind back to these three attributes?
Okay.
Uh-huh. That's all it's saying. Right?
It seems like if you were concentrated on the meaning of it, you could really get sort of scattered.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah, that happens. That's exactly what the point is. You know, if you think of, if your word is peace, for example, I just gave that example last time in my class. If your mantra is peace and you're chanting peace, 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 I want peace with my family, peace, peace, I want peace in the Middle East, peace, peace, I want peace with these, and then you can suddenly start going to Middle East, maybe, I went on a trip to Middle East last time, I had so much fun, this and that, And then everything is gone after that.
You just have to bring yourself back.
Bring it back. So stay within the framework of these three attributes.
So
you have to sort of put boundaries around the framework.
That's right.
Otherwise, we're just...
Otherwise, it'll be too scattered. Don't make it too wide.
Smart.
That's why my meditation is so hard.
when you are, I don't have experience using a mantra. I usually just use my breath.
That's fine.
But I like the idea of a mantra. Is that usually said externally or just in your mind?
In your mind.
Okay.
We don't, well... There are certain techniques wherein you can chant the mantra loud in the beginning. But when you chant it loud, it will be considered dharana.
Okay.
Like Om chant. Okay. There is a technique in meditation where you start out chanting the mantra Om very loud. Not very loud, I mean loud. Om. You actually will sound it out. Okay. And that is supposed to bring you to a state of dharana. Dharana is that initial state of focus. Once you have done that for a period of time, then you have to do it quietly. The dhyana part is always done with quiet chanting. People sing bhajans, for example. Bhajan is a... What's a bhajan?
Is it, you know, a state of dharana? Like,
you know. No. What's a bhajan? Bhajan is a...
Bhajan is like chanting.
Like chanting a musical note, you know. Recital of a song, for example, bhajan, you know.
Kirtan.
Kirtan is another form of that, same thing. What's kirtan? Kirtan is repetitive, singing the same sounds repetitively, singing in a musical note. Okay, it has, kirtan means it's a musical note. But musically singing something for a repeated number of times. Okay, that becomes kirtan. And again, that's used as a form of dharana. Initial focus, because that really brings your mind into a state of peace and quiet eventually. Having done that for enough length of time, transition to your dhyana state. That's important. So bhajan, kirtan, looking at physical pictures, there are mandalas and yantras and all the different things, all different aspects of dharana. There's another very commonly used practice in India. It is the use of a mala. Anybody know what mala is?
Yeah. The beads.
With the beads, yeah. Mm-hmm. There are 108 beads in there. And you use the beads one at a time, move, and with each movement you chant something in the mind. And that becomes very beautifully meditative eventually. Okay? So... They're all forms of dharana, okay? So then mantra meditation becomes our dhyana. Concentration fluctuates between different aspects. I sense remains, I am meditating. That means I am in the process of focusing on this object of meditation. That I sense remains. Then, what is samadhi? So again, the Sanskrit word is, you can repeat after me, tadeva.
Tadeva.
Artha matra nirbhasam swarupa shunyam
eva.
That is the definition of samadhi. Samadhi. Okay, let me do that again, one more time. Tadeva. Artha matram. Nirbhasam, swarupa shunyam eva, samadhi. Okay, now, what does that mean? When you are able to focus your mind in dhyana, okay, tadeva means at that time, again, tadeva means only then, tadeva, artha matram nirbhasa, you are, artha means the essential meaning of your object of meditation. Of a mantra, for example, what is the essential meaning? What is the essential basically what's the essence of that mantra? Artha matra means only the meaning remains. The awareness, nirbhasa means awareness, the only awareness that you have in your mind is what the essential meaning of that mantra is. Then you don't think of it sound. Shabda goes away. Jnana goes away. That's what we were talking about, right? It says, forget about the shabda, no more sound, no more vibration, no more feeling of the word itself. I am completely eliminating all the other surrounding knowledge about that object. What's the essence of that object? That's all that remains in my mind. And swarupa shunyam eva. Swarupa means I-ness, you know, my own true, my own being. I'm devoid of even knowing who I am at that point. It's a very deep state. Again, I can only talk about it intellectually because this is the state I have not experienced it. So I really cannot explain that from experience.
Are there people living in this world?
Of course, yeah. There are many people. Yeah. All these, I mean, they claim to be realized. My own teacher in the Yogaville, Swami Sachidananda, I mean, everyone claims that he was realized.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the stuff that I've read says that once you get realized, you really don't need all these techniques anymore.
That's right.
It's illusional. You can leave it all behind you.
Yes. But there is a danger, they say. You know, if you leave it all behind and you suddenly fall back into your worldliness and suddenly see something very nice and attractive and you fall into that, and then you can fall back. So you have to keep the practice going.
Unrealized.
Then you become unrealized, yes. It has happened to some people, yeah, many people. Mm.
I mean, are there characteristics or like examples of, you know, realization? I mean, how do you know, like, you know, somebody is realized?
You cannot. And people who are realized, they are not supposed to tell, because then if they start telling that I'm realized, then it's their ego. If the ego is still there, then you're not realized. When you realize, there is no ego. That means you have no reason to tell anybody that you are realized.
Would they know, like, you know, that they realized? You know?
They may or they may not. You know. Like if you read the book, you know, I gave the example of this book called The Power of Now. Mm-hmm. Anybody know that book?
Yes.
You've read that book?
Yes,
right? In the very beginning of that book, Eckhart Tolle says that I was realized. He says that. In that book, yeah. He says, I had that experience, deep spiritual experience, and I got that sudden light. Okay? That's realization.
Is that kind of like flow state, like when you're painting, you just mentioned a little while ago, like when you're in a creative state and you're just in flow with it and you lose track of time? That's the feeling?
That's the feeling that you can eventually, if you can sustain that for the entire duration of your life, that's real samadhi.
Yeah.
Okay?
And retain that and also participate in the world at the same time.
Absolutely.
So it
seems like, you know, this total absorption could be a thing that you might get a glimmer of if you have a really nice meditation session. You might get a sense of what it would feel like to lose your sense of self. And I think that happens probably for different reasons to different people, little glimmers. But so the idea, though, is that to sort of be living in a state of that
permanently.
Okay.
Yes.
And still, you know, make a grocery list.
Hmm?
And still, like, make a grocery list. And
absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. Then you will do everything without the involvement of ego. Okay. Then you will make a grocery list. Not because I must have this, otherwise I'm going to die. You know, in my grocery list, if I don't have a cup, you know, this particular brand of coffee, I'm not going to enjoy my food. Okay, that's ego.
Yeah.
Okay.
But how do you know, like if something really bad happens, like say for instance, somebody you love dies, like you wouldn't know how, like if you're in a state of flow or samadhi, like. I think, like, you have to read something to kind of stay on track so you know how, like, you're supposed to be. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it happens all the time, right? People, you can fall out of it, but then you have to get back to it. I'm giving you my personal example, right? I lost my wife recently. Most of you, I think everyone knows that, right? And for a long time, I was fine. No problem. And 2 months ago, suddenly I got into a state of depression. It happens. Because I'm not in a state of samadhi, I'm not realized, I got into that state. I had to take 5 weeks off from my classes.
But for instance, in that, like for instance, when you do lose somebody you care about or something really bad happens, how do you know if you're in a state of samadhi, how you're reacting to
it? Once you are in a state of samadhi, then you are able to completely isolate yourself from any continuous feeling of depression or loss. Okay, then you are able to rationalize that this is life, you know, this is life, this happens to everybody, there's no question. Whoever comes into this life has to leave this life, etc., etc. All these things will happen eventually. But that's a very deep state, that of realization. It's hard. Like I said, I went through it personally now.
So help me understand. You said, you know, you experienced, you know, depression, you know, for 5 weeks. And what helped you, like, to come out of it?
Again, deep meditation. I did a lot of meditation, reflection. I was in a state for almost 2 weeks, in that state.
Do you have any deep, close personal friends that helped you through it at all?
My sister. I was in Chicago with my sister. Yeah. She was a great help. Good. Yes.
So when you're meditating on something that's overwhelming to you, is it just an acceptance of that feeling?
Yes, it's an acceptance of the feeling and without judgment then. Without judgment, without...
I've heard that called radical acceptance.
Well, whatever you want to call it, you know, but it's acceptance, yes.
It's pretty radical.
Yeah.
It seems like in like stories, there's a moment where somebody enters samadhi and then it's effortless, like they just live in that state without any effort. But it's hard for me to... It seems like you were saying if you can slip back. If anything, if you don't, it's like use it or lose it. It seems like you would have to always be struggling. In order to keep pursuing, it just seems like something that would be like an endless pursuit. And not like a destination, but more of like a...
It's a pursuit. Right? You know, I agree with that. It's a pursuit, they say. You know, they say that some people have stayed in that for their entire life. Ramana Maharishi is a good example of a person who, you know, who just stayed in that state until the end of his life. No problem. So many people, Vivekananda is supposed to be that way. You know, there's Swami Ramakrishna, for example. It's a very commonly mentioned example. These are all the people in the Indian culture. And they're not very old. They're not very ancient. They're more recent people. There are people who have lived with them and experienced their oneness with them.
What did they do?
They were realized completely. All you had to do, they say, for example, Ramana Maharishi, he didn't speak much. He spoke no English, no nothing. He only spoke his own native language, Tamil. That's it. And people would go there, sit in his presence, sit there in front of him. Mm-hmm. He would not talk, you would not talk. And you'd become peaceful.
He may have achieved this through many lifetimes. It may not just be this.
Yeah, that's exactly what they say.
So all of us, some of us are further along than others. So
absolutely.
That's why...
Yeah, but Raman Maharishi, they say he was realized based on his previous lives. But people used to go there, and there are people who came from all over the world, sat in front of him, and they didn't understand a word of what he was saying. And yet they felt so peaceful, so calm, and there were thousands of people who came that way in front of him.
Calm, not like crying tears of joy or just peace.
No, tears of joy would come too. That happens.
There was a performance artist who did this thing where she, for just like days, would just have people would come and she would just look into their eyes for like 20 minutes, and there was lines of people who just... And there's a documentary, I can't remember her name, but... It was just like, it was very intense. And she would just kind of look up and then they would share this eye contact for as long as the reactions were.
There are many stories like this.
Yeah.
Raman Maharishi, Ramakrishna, very famous person. People would just go and sit there. You know, he used to give talks in his language, Bengali. And
there's a man named Thich Nhat Hanh
Yes. He's also very, very...
He's older now, but he goes all over and spoken to Oprah. And you can just, even through the television, you can feel...
Yes.
You immediately calm down. Like,
well,
I
these,
calm.
You know, these people have that aura, you know, and they bring about certain emotions in you. I don't know. Raman Maharishi is a common example everyone gives him, because people who would go there, they would just feel very peaceful, very calm, and then come back and stay in that state for a long period of time.
But it seems like those people kind of isolate themselves, not take so much, but they kind of do, because they're kind of like in their own community, and like people come to them.
Yeah. What else would they do? They have to stay somewhere.
I mean, is the question, you know, they're not like, you know, ordinary people like doing like, you know, jobs, you know,
being, yeah,
like, having managers, you know, telling like, you know, what to do in your life and things like those. You know? I mean, nobody's dictating
stuff.
Them, you know, they kind of isolate themselves.
But then somebody else is bringing them food and stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that happens.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's easier. I think what we're all getting to is it seems like it'd be really easy to achieve.
Isolated.
That's all you had to do, whereas the rest of us are in the day-to-day world.
Well, you know, the example, other example people give is, you know, these people like Swami Satchidananda.
Yeah.
He lived a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
He used to work on his own, you know, he used to fix his own cars. He was a mechanic.
Wow.
He used to fix his own cars, and yet they say he was realized.
Well, and he oversaw and did the construction of Yogaville.
Yeah, he oversaw the construction of Yogaville, the construction of everything that went around there. He went around and gave talks.
Mm-hmm.
He was the chief guest at that music festival in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
I
heard him say
Woodstock.
He never went anywhere unless he was invited. He said, I don't know where I'm going. He said, I only go where they tell me to go.
Yeah, of course. What else would he do? Yeah.
But what about being married?
Yeah, he was married at one time.
Can you have children?
Sure, why not? Why not?
It's hard to do.
There are always examples of everything in everybody, everyone in these situations. People, there's an Indian story there was a king by the name Janaka. He had his daughter Sita and all that, you know. And they claimed this guy, even though he was married, he was the king, and he did everything in this life, but he was completely realized, they say.
Iyengar.
Totally realized.
Iyengar was married and had children.
Iyengar was married and had children, yeah.
He lost his wife too, like such a
yeah.
young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that some of this is, we can sit and we can talk about this grand state of self-realization and wanting to reach there and be there. But I also think we have to be careful and not make that our goal so much. And maybe it's our goal, but also can't we just take some things from this and apply it to our lives and make our lives better?
Yes. Why not?
And then... You know, if we reach this wonderful state, great. If we don't...
we suffer a little bit, but...
We suffer a little bit, yeah. Right.
I mean, but to completely eliminate suffering...
We're going for it too much, too.
Completely eliminate... I see what you're saying. You don't want to stress yourself out.
Trying to reach some...
Please, yeah.
Because
yeah.
That's what happens to me sometimes when something bad happens. I'll be like, I think about how upset I am about it. It almost makes the problem worse because I'm so
yes.
anxious about how anxious I am about
That's
it.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Yep, very true. Okay. Very good. This thing goes off after some time.
Are you plugged in, into that laptop? Is it powered? Is the laptop powered?
Oh, maybe that's what happened.
Yeah, I think you might have a timeout on the laptop.
Yes.
So every few minutes, you don't use it, it just goes and sleeps. I mean, if you plugged it in, then it wouldn't. So
not plugged in. It's even if it is plugged into the power, you mean?
Yeah.
It will still do the same
then,
thing.
Then, you might have a timeout setting,
It is.
Five
it's
minutes
a,
or something.
Yeah, it is timed out, yeah. Okay, so that's the samadhi part. All right. Now, what Patanjali says in the Yoga Sutra, Chapter 3, is that he defines this term called Sanyama. S-A-M-Y-A-M-A, Sanyama. And the Sutra is very simple. So, again, you repeat after me. Trayam, Ekatra, Sanyamaha. Trayam, Ekatra, Sanyamaha. Traya means these three. Ekatra means together. These three together, that means dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. When you do it all together on one object, then it's called sanyama. That's the word. It's a technical word that Patanjali uses in this entire chapter 3. There's nothing much to it. Okay? So, again, you know, there are some commentators who believe that it is not absolutely essential that you should do dharana also on the same object. Some believe that this sutra means that you have to do the dharana also on the same object. Some believe that it doesn't necessarily have to be. So it's up to, you know, us to kind of interpret it with the way we want to do it. Okay? You want to focus on something in your dhyana and meditation. And what you want to focus on is given in this chapter for different attainments that you want to achieve. Okay? So many supernatural powers based on the practice are mentioned in that. Okay. All right. So, from here, what he's saying now in this one, again, the sutra is, let me recite the sutra first. So, repeat. Trayam. Antarangam. Purvebhyah. So, trayam. Antarangam. Purvebhyah. Trayam means these three. Antarangam. What's antarangam means? Internal. Internal. These three are internal as compared to what? Purvebhyah. Purva means before. The five angas that came before these three, compared to these three are internal to the mind. Those were external to the mind. That's what it's saying. They're more intimate to the mind and less intimate to the mind. So what are the five? Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, and Pratyahara. Those five, they are considered external to the mind, and these three are considered internal to the mind. They are very intimate with the mind. Antarangam. Okay? So that's all. It's nothing much to it. This sutra is very simple, just to tell you that we're going deeper inside the mind now. Okay? Okay, so it's removed from the five senses, and the objective is purification of the mind. And I don't know where I got this. The first five are for the purification of the body. That's not true. that's a wrong statement I picked up from somewhere. Because yamas and niyamas are for the purification of the mind. Okay, so it's not true from, I don't know where I got it from. I need to change that. But everything is essential. You know, it doesn't say that you don't go through the five limbs. Okay? Now, the next one says, what's the Nirbija Samadhi, okay? So, again, the sutra is, Tadapi Bahirangam Nirbijasya Tadapi Bahirangam Nirbijasya. What does that mean? Tadapi, even these three that we just talked about, even these three, tadapi, bahiranga, antaranga means internal, bahiranga means external. So, if you are talking about nirbija or seedless samadhi, then everything is external to that. Why? Because in the Nirbija Samadhi, we are talking about realizing Purusha. Purusha is pure consciousness. Purusha is pure awareness, pure consciousness. Purusha is the soul, the self, the Atma. Okay? Prakriti is everything that is material. Okay? Every object of meditation is an element of Prakriti. Remember those 23 elements that we talked about, they belong to Prakriti, material being. And that is external, disjointed from Purusha. Therefore, it is Bahiranga. Bahiranga means not intimate with Purusha. Okay? So everything that we talked about so far, all these eight limbs, they become external when they are compared to the state of Nirbija Samadhi. Bija means seed. What's a seed? What does a seed do?
Sprout.
Seed can sprout. Right? So every seed has the capability of sprouting into something more. Okay? That's what it says. Alright? So if you pick a word, any word, for example, for meditation, it may, you may reach a state where you are completely calm for a period of time, but then it, if that seed still remains, it's going to sprout into other thoughts, other vrittis, other things might happen in the mind. So that's why you need to, eventually, that's the goal, Nirbija Samadhi. How do you get there? I don't know. Just keep trying.
In this context, you know, the Nirbija is, you know, does it mean no distractions?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Bija is, you know, I mean, you can, something can come out of it. Nirbija is like totally nothing.
Right. So, you know, Sanyamaya, like we said, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi in general, as long as you are in that state which is called a Sampragnyata Samadhi, you need one of these objects of meditation, one of the seeds of meditation. All objects are a part of Prakriti, which is external from the point of view of Purusha. Thus, only the seedless Samadhi is what you can call internal. Okay? All right. Now, from here on, Patanjali talks about the mental transformation that happens when you go through these techniques of meditation. Okay, what happens in the mind? What kind of changes go on in the mind? Okay. Now, he starts with the Nirodha Parinama. Parinama is the transformation, the word Parinama. So you'll hear that word Parinama very frequently in this discussion, because Parinama means transformation. What transformation do we go through while we are in the state of meditation? Okay. So he first talks about the very final stage of meditation. Where the final stage means you are in the Nirodha state. Nirodha means complete suppression of all thought waves. Okay. That's the goal of yoga. Okay, so these are long words in Sanskrit, so you'll have to bear with me, but try and do the best. Repeat after me. Vyutthana.
Vyutthana.
Nirodha.
Nirodha.
Sanskara yoho.
Sanskara yoho.
Abhibhava.
Abhibhava.
Pradurbhavau.
Pradurbhavau.
Nirodhakshara.
Nirodhakshara.
Chittanvayah.
Chittanvayah.
Nirodha parinamaha. These are, like I said, these are long words, these are Sanskrit words, but we'll go through each word, okay? So don't worry about that. So let's repeat it. Vyutthana, Nirodha,
Sanskara Yoho,
Abhibhava,
Pradurbhavau,
Nirodhakshana, Chittanvayo, Nirodha Parinamaha. All right. What does that mean now? It might be easier if I go through the next two first, because this is the last stage. It will be easier for me to explain it that way. Let me see if that helps. Let's start with this. I think it'll be easier for me to explain the whole process, because this is the initial stage. Okay, let's start with this. and we'll go back to the previous one after that. All right, so let's repeat this now. Sarvarthata ekagratayoho kshayodayau chittasya samadhi parinamaha. So one more time. Sarvarthata ekagratayoho. There is a spelling error in Sanskrit there. Kshayodayau chittasya samadhi parinamaha. Okay, now it's a definition of something he calls samadhi parinama. Samadhi parinama is transformation. Samadhi transformation, that's the meaning. Initial stage of the meditation, he says, is when your mind goes, and I'm going to make a sentence out of the Sanskrit word so you can understand the context of these words. So the first word is sarvarthata, and then there is ekagrata. So you are going back and forth between sarvarthata and ekagrata. Now what do these two mean? Sarva means all. Sarvarthata means your mind is all over the place. Your mind is completely scattered. You are almost in the kshipta state, basically. Kshipta is the scattered state. Okay. From there, ekagrata. Remember the word ekagrata? We talked about that. One-pointedness, single point of focus. So, when... What kshaya, so there are the two words are kshaya and udaya. Kshaya means suppression. Udaya means to come up. Okay, kshaya means suppression, diminishing something, that's called kshaya. Udaya means bringing something up. When you say sun rises, you say suryodaya. That means surya, udaya happens. Udaya means rising up, bringing up. So what does this mean? It says that when there is a suppression of all pointedness, sarvarthata, that means when there is suppression of scatteredness and rising of focus, that means focus comes up and the all pointedness diminishes, okay? Then that state of the mind, that conjunction, where you can, when the mind feels that there is a transition happening now between from all pointedness to one pointedness, that he terms as samadhi parinama. He calls it samadhi has happened, or the transformation of samadhi has taken place. That's the definition of this samadhi parinama. The translation that I have is from this book by Swami Satchidananda. When there is decline in distractedness and appearance of one-pointedness, then comes the samadhi parinama, development in samadhi. No, you haven't attained the state of Nirodha yet.
Right.
That's the first, that we're coming there. We're slowly getting there.
Gotcha.
Okay. So this is the conjunction in the mind where you feel that the mind has settled down from all these mundane day-to-day distractions that we go through. Mundane thoughts like, oh, I have to do some grocery, I have to plan for this party, I have to go take my kids to the school, etc., you know, all these things, you know, I have to prepare for this, my talk in my workplace, I have to talk to my boss tomorrow, things like that. These are all the things that are at a surface level, not very deep in your consciousness yet, not very deep in your samskara level, not deep in your subconscious level, but these are more stuff that is much, much, much more at the surface level. That's why.
I'd let you know.
That's why the whole The mind is completely scattered because they are all at the surface level. Okay, so when there's decline, kshaya is decline. When there's decline in this all-pointedness and emergence of ekagrata. Ekagrata means one-pointedness, focus, concentration happens. That conjunction that you feel in the mind, that is called samadhi parinama. Okay? Okay. Vritti is created by mundane thoughts. Ekagrata is the same object stays in the mind field for some time. And ekagrata parinama is the transformation wherein distractedness is diminished and one-pointedness is retained. Okay. Now, we come to the next stage. So it's stage by stage, okay? So we're going into the next stage now. All right? So again, repeat after me. Tataha.
Tataha.
Punaha.
Punaha.
Shh. Oh boy, there's a mistake here. It should be shantoditau.
Shantoditau.
I misspelled it. Shantoditau. Tulya pratyayau. Chittasya.
Ekagrata.
Parinamaha. Okay. Then again, tataha puna means then again. What happens? When the thoughts that have been suppressed, shanta means peaceful, you know, which has been suppressed already. Shanta means the old ones which have been suppressed. Udita means, again the same thing, udaya, udita, which have been brought up. Okay. When what has been suppressed and what has been brought up, they are the same. Tulya pratyayo. Tulya means the identical. Okay? So the content of the mind, pratyaya is the content of the mind. Content of the mind, when some object has been suppressed, some has been brought up. What did we do in the past, previous one? We suppressed the all-pointedness and brought in the one-pointedness. Or,
you're using this word suppress. I mean, I thought I'd heard you and other teachers describe the situation where extraneous thoughts are not suppressed, that if you suppress them, it gives you the idea that you're battling with them.
I know, but that's not the sense we are using it here for.
Yeah, there's no Sanskrit word for suppress here.
No, shanta. Shanta is
shanta.
Diminished.
Okay, but that's not the same thing as suppressed.
It's not the same thing as suppressed, yeah, but you know.
Calming, and shanta is like, you know, calming.
Calming, quieting. Yeah.
Right.
Quieting the down thing, settling it down.
You know, we're not suppressing.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I know English, you know, when we translate these things to English, it is a little hard. Because not easy to sometimes translate these exact words into English. So shanti means peace, for example. Shanti is peace. Shanta means something which has been pacified, which has been subdued in a sense. Okay, so all those thoughts which were completely bothering us all the time, we have been able to sublimate them in a sense. Okay. So when it's the same object which was diminished, which was, what's the other word we used?
Quieting
or whatever. It's hard to put these words into
diminished.
Okay. When they are identical over a period of time, that is called the ekagrata parinama. Now we are one step higher. Okay. So now it's not coming from all-pointedness to one-pointedness, but one-pointedness to one-pointedness. Okay? So that is a much higher state of meditation. That's called the ekagrata parinama. Oops, what happened? Okay. Okay. Now, we're going back to this number 9, where we said we'll come back to it later. So, we started with Sarvarthata, which is all-pointedness. We went to Ekagrata, which is one-pointedness. And from Ekagrata, we're going to go into Nirodha, total elimination, so to say. Okay, suppression, elimination, completely. All right, let's go through this again. So, again, repeat after me. Vyutthan, Nirodha, Sanskara Yoho, Abhibhava, Pradurbhavau, Nirodhakshana, Chittanvayo, Nirodha Parinamaha. All right. Now, what do these words mean? Vyutthana means, again, rising, something that comes up. What is coming up in this one? What is the commentators say what this represents is what's coming up from your deep levels of subconscious. See, when you have been able to kind of calm the surface waves, so to say, you know, Sarvarthata were the surface waves. When you've been able to calm the surface waves, what comes up from the deep state of subconscious levels? That's when things start coming up from the deep state of subconscious levels. Some old memories, some old hurts, some guilt feelings from 20 years ago, you know, some fights that you picked up, something that made you very happy. Those things might start coming up. So, commentators say that that's Vyutthana. Okay? So, we're not now tackling the mundane, day-to-day stuff. It's now something that comes up from the base, from the very root. And this could be a combination of Kshipta, Mudha, Vikshipta, all these states eventually, you know, they all create impressions in the mind at every deep level. And then those things come up, Vyutthana. But through our deep state of meditation, we are able to get into moments of Nirodha. Nirodha is total quiet, total peace, no thought, okay? So from these Vyutthana thoughts, vrittis, which are coming from the deep states of consciousness, subconsciousness, to a state of Nirodha. Nirodha means
stopping
something, completely eliminating that thought, okay? So when these sanskaras, does everyone know the meaning of word sanskara?
Memories.
Sanskara.
The memories,
past impressions.
Past impressions.
So what we are doing is, from the sanskaras, from these past impressions that are erupting in our mind from our base, from a very deep subconscious level, we are now depositing the samskara of Nirodha. It's a very difficult concept to understand. Nirodha is when there's nothing in the mind. It doesn't matter what's in the mind, whether it's nothingness or something, it's going to create an impression in the mind. It's going to create a samskara in the mind. So what this guy is saying is, what this sutra is saying is, that from... we are transitioning from the sanskara, which were deep-seated in our subconscious. They come up, they erupt in the mind, and we are able to kind of eliminate those, kshaya, diminish those, and instead bring in the sanskara of Nirodha. Nirodha is nothingness. When I was reading, studying this, you know, I'm still not 100% sure, but this was a very, very difficult concept for me to understand.
I'm sorry, I have to leave. Thank you so much.
Sorry. Thank you. I think we are kind of running late today. Let me just finish this thought, then we'll be done after this. Okay? Does everyone kind of get it?
So does this actually say we're going from everythingness, you know, mind being distracted everywhere, to like, you know, oneness, one-pointedness. And the next stage, you know, after one-pointedness is
this,
the suppression, you know, the
Nirodha. Yes.
Okay.
So that's the step by step. Sarvarthata, ekagrata, nirodha. Very good. That's the transition that we are going through in our mind. Okay? So that's the progression that we are taking to get there. Okay? You get this concept roughly? Okay, so from vyutthana, we are getting into nirodha, and abhibhava and pradurbhava is the same thing. Abhibhava is to diminish something, bringing it down. Pradurbhava is to bring it up. There are different words from the same concept. Kshaya, udaya. Abhibhava, pradurbhava. They mean exactly the same thing in Sanskrit. Okay? So from these, when you are able to attain that moment, nirodha kshana. Kshana means the moment. Kshana means moment. Nirodha kshana means the moment of completely of nothingness. Moment means, nirodha means nothingness. That moment, that conjunction of the mind, it's called nirodha parinama. That transformation is called the nirodha parinama. And that's our goal. Eventually, our goal is to attain that state of nirodha parinama. Nirodha state. Niruddha state is the final state of total nothingness. And eventually, it leads to seedless samadhi. Nirbija samadhi, eventually. Okay? It will lead to that. Once that happens, you are in a pure state of unadulterated bliss. If you want to call it that way. If you ever get there. All right. So that completes our discussion that I had in mind for meditation. And it took us almost like 4 sessions to do this meditation part. But unfortunately, not everyone is present every time, so you kind of miss the link, miss the chain. But I hope, you know, like Karen was saying, it's all there on my podcast, so you can always go back and listen to it. That's how, you know, she keeps in touch. I hope it's getting recorded, and I hope to be able to again upload it on my podcast. Okay, so let's.